Hello, and welcome to the Royal Air Force Museum podcast. I'm Dr. Harry Rafal, and in today's episode, I'm joined by Harry Smee, the author of a new biography on Frank Brock, entitled Gunpowder and Glory. Now, Harry is the grandson of Frank Brock, and in the 1980s was the director of Brock's Fireworks. Harry brings a wealth of personal knowledge to this topic, and Frank Brock's association with the Air Force, as well as his background in pyrotechnics and his association with London, meant that I really enjoyed this conversation. During the First World War, Frank Brock had the distinction of serving in the Army, Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force before he was killed in the famous 1918 raid on Zeebrugge. Brock, described as an inventive genius in the official history of the Royal Air Force in the First World War, is perhaps most famous for his role in defeating the Zeppelin menace through his invention of the Brock bullet. The Brock bullet was a high-explosive incendiary bullet filled with potassium chlorate and with a nose sensitive enough to explode on contact with the balloon fabric, and it was exceedingly effective against the hydrogen-filled German airships. Harry and I discussed the use of the Brock bullet when the first Zeppelin was brought down over England. Before this, however, we discussed Brock's first operation of the Royal Naval Air Service when he was involved in the bombing raid on Friedrichshafen. Since this conversation, where Harry and I discussed Frank's involvement in this raid, Harry has provided some further details. Brock's brother, the historian Alan Brock, recorded that, in addition to Frank's intense and prescient interest in finding a solution to the Zeppelin menace and his personal knowledge of the works in Friedrichshafen, Frank accompanied the raid to superintend personally the installation of the special incendiary and explosive bombs which he had designed for the occasion. Now, we don't know if in the event these bombs were used or not, but it helps convey the skills that made Brock an asset to the armed forces in the First World War. During this conversation, we also discussed the smoke floats that Brock invented and the Dover flare, which was used as part of the anti-submarine barrage across the Channel. Brock was a prolific inventor, and he also invented the Brock colour filter and developed colour flares, the technology behind which was subsequently used by the Pathfinder Force in the Second World War. Finally, Harry and I discussed the Zeebrugge raid, Brock's innovative smokescreen, and his death in a sword fight on the Zeebrugge Mole. As I said, I really enjoyed the conversation Harry and I had, so I hope you all enjoy. Hi, Harry, great to speak to you today. Before we get into the detail of Frank Brock's extraordinary life, can you give our audience a little of a background of Brock's fireworks and Frank's association?
Yes, by all means. Brock's was a family firework enterprise that began in the late 17th century and went on through eight generations. Frank was the eighth generation of pyrotechnist. It was mainly based in London or around London. What would happen with firework businesses is that you would need space, but you also needed people. So you would go to the edge of a urban area, put down your business there, and then not long after that, people would start living around you, and you had to move again. So they moved around from London and ended up in the south of London. And by the time Frank came along, they had a factory in South Norwood. And they were pyrotechnists to the Crystal Palace, where their efforts were really deeply involved with entertaining Londoners, entertaining people from all over the world who would visit London, and also a part of the British diplomatic efforts. If any important visitor arrived, the Shah, the Tsar, the Kaiser, anybody of that nature, they would pop along usually with the Prince of Wales, later to become Edward VII, and they would have a wonderful display at the Crystal Palace.
I was really excited when we first spoke, because this is a topic which covers things that I really love. Frank Brock's life is extraordinary in itself, but the fireworks aspect of it, I mean, I love fireworks. From a kid, I grew up lighting them off, probably very irresponsibly, should not be encouraged today. But I'm also a Londoner. I grew up just south of Crystal Palace in West Norwood, so it's a very local story for me as well. Frank's life is very much a London life, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. He went to school in Dulwich with all his brothers as a day boy. There he famously blew up a stove in his classroom and was not caned, surprisingly, because the headmaster admired him, so he let him off a caning. But he left an impression everybody knew about Frank after he'd left. He was a sportsman. He was a very good shot. He was said to have shot a snipe with a revolver, which is extremely difficult. He played rugger for Richmond at that time, one of the biggest clubs in the country. And he traveled. That was the thing about him. He traveled all over the world to virtually every continent. He would take with him men when he traveled. He was responsible for them. He would have put on his fireworks in front of crowds up to a million strong. He was responsible for their safety. So from a very young age, he took terrific responsibility on his shoulders. And I think that probably showed up later on in his military and naval career.
Yeah, we're going to pick up. He seemed to be an extraordinary leader of men as well as a very inventive mind. The fireworks side of it, that, can you just run us through what he was involved in and how he merged to the First World War?
His father and his uncle, Arthur Brock and Charles Brock, were brilliant men in themselves. And they had developed and pioneered and patented all sorts of different things, in particular illuminating material, magnesium and aluminium. And they had patented new fireworks, in particular set pieces, which were anything up to an eighth of a mile long and 100 feet high. These set pieces were the centerpiece of their displays at Crystal Palace. They were very famous, and they were used in their posters for their displays. And the dust cover for Gunpowder and Glory shows the 1909 poster, which would have been such a set piece, but which by that time was using zeppelins and aeroplanes attacking zeppelins and ground-based cannon turned vertically to attack the zeppelins, searchlights. There were all sorts of things going on, and I suspect it was among the first, if not the first, artistic representation of recognizable aerial warfare.
Yeah, I think it's a really striking image, the dust cover of your book. As you say, from the 1909 set piece, I think for a modern audience, perhaps some of whom are old enough to remember Brock's before it merged into other companies, a younger audience might know Black Cats a little bit better. But at this point, huge spectacles being put on. And these were the posters for them. But they had very large audiences come, didn't they?
Yes, they had. And almost, I mean, the brand name was known all the way across the world.
I think it's important to convey that point, because Frank Brock doesn't emerge into the First World War with no basis upon which to create these extraordinary inventions of his. There's this big infrastructure he's emerged from, so he knows how to command men, and he has the technical knowledge. But I think we should discuss the cover, because I think it's very striking. And apart from the sort of earlier images in terms of artistic representations of balloons being used in warfare, I think for a modern audience used to aircraft, you know, heavier than air machines, this is perhaps the first artistic representation of modern warfare.
Yes, the Wright brothers carried out their very first flight on the 17th of December 1903. By 1908, the people on both sides of the Atlantic were getting hysterical about the prospect of zeppelins, airships, bombing ordinary civilians. H.G. Wells had written War in the Air. But the illustrations in H.G. Wells' book, as far as I can make out, are not recognizable to anybody nowadays as recognizable implements of warfare in the air. The airships look like deflating gas bags, and if there are aeroplanes, they just look like planks with fins on. Whereas this particular poster, which would have been produced by the Brock's art department, has in it things which look like aeroplanes and things which look like zeppelins. And I think it's a very, very powerful piece of artwork.
I agree. And H.G. Wells, for an audience listening, it's probably best to picture a canoe with some planks along it and a propeller at both ends. And that's men crowded along, sort of firing broadsides, sort of early naval warfare comes to mind. But no, it's a great image. But let's dive into Frank's life in terms of the services, because we're going to come on to the Brock bullet, which is, of course, really important in terms of defeating the Zeppelin menace. It's a high explosive incendiary. But before we do that, he didn't just reach the Zeppelin threat from an inventor's standpoint, trying to think of a clever way of defeating it. He was very much involved early on in the Royal Naval Air Service's attempts to directly counter the Zeppelin threat, wasn't he?
Yes. His family had been producing military pyrotechnics since at least the Franco-Prussian War. That's Napoleon III's armies with a lot of military pyrotechnics. And in the 1890s, his father, Arthur Brock, had invented the trip flare, which was now so ubiquitous that it's in every military in the world. So he was used to supplying the armed forces. And before the war began, we believe he was working with the government. Before the war, he'd visited the Friedrichshafen works where all the Zeppelins were made on Lake Constance, on the north shore of Lake Constance. And pretending to be an American, he'd gone in to have a quick look, or as detailed a look as he could, at the Zeppelin. He'd also been negotiating contracts with the Dusseldorf Exhibition Center, one of those huge German exhibition centers, right up until July of 1914. So he'd been representing Brock's in those negotiations. And I think it's highly likely he would have probably taken the opportunity to nip over and have a look at the Dusseldorf airship base as well. So he didn't come in with no experience. And he certainly had terrific experience of managing men and carrying this very heavy responsibility, which I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and the Friedrichshafen raid, which takes place early on in the First World War, is a really interesting one, because it's this sort of early attempt to undertake long-range bombing with a definite aim in mind. But the Zeppelin threat, it's easy to imagine it now because it was defeated, as always, you know, it's inevitable, but it wasn't going to have this large impact. But of course, it grew during the war to sort of 1916, where there was a real fear about its sort of long-term impact on Britain's ability to continue the war. And that was something which was in the air, you know, before the war started. It's definitely something which Frank Brock seemed to have been concerned about himself. He seemed to have given it some thought before the war broke out.
Yes, he'd thought about it. Like, you know, millions of people on both sides of the Atlantic, they were terrified, because although towns had been put under siege before with attacking artillery dropping shells on them, they'd never been bombed from the air. And this was a very, very frightening concept. So I think millions of people were frightened. The Germans had already actually, in 1908, the same year that H.G. Wells published War in the Air, the Germans had mentioned that they could use Zeppelin airships to destroy Britain. We were worried about being bombed from the air in our towns, but we were also worried about our one big advantage, which was our Royal Navy and superiority on the seas, being negated by the Germans floating around in their airships and spying on exactly where we were.
Okay, so let's go into Friedrichshafen, because it's a fascinating episode in the war, one that's little known about, the attempt to have this long-range bombing very early on in 1914. Can you just give us the background of the raid and what happened?
Yes. Very soon after the war began, Murray Souter, who ran the RNAS, went to his boss, who was Winston Churchill, as the First Lord of the Admiralty, and he got permission to carry out raids on the Zeppelin works at Friedrichshafen, and also at basically wherever they were. So they were at Dusseldorf in a big airship base there. They were down in Friedrichshafen, and he got permission to attack them. And so these were the first strategic bombing raids in history, and they were carried out by the RNAS. And Souter chose a man called Pemberton Billing, who was an extraordinary man and an inventor, but similar to Frank in some ways. And they went down to Paris. They left London. Frank left London on his wedding day. He got married, I think, at lunchtime, had a glass of champagne, and then shot off to France. And in Paris, they were given false papers by the consul general, and then they went on down to the Swiss border, where they managed to trick their way over into Switzerland, and went along the southern shore of Lake Constance until they got to the point opposite Friedrichshafen. They then hired a boat and went over to Friedrichshafen. Pemberton Billings went ashore and wrecked the town, making notes and so on. And then he agreed to meet Frank at the shore the next night. So he had time to kill. So he went and slept in a house, and there he was woken by three German officers coming back. It was bad news. He jumped out of the window, grabbing an ornamental lion from the mantelpiece. He knocked out the officer's driver, and in their car, he zoomed off to the shore. And Frank was there, and he got back in the boat and rowed back to the Swiss side and made their way back to Belfort. Belfort was a French airship base close to the Swiss border. And there, Frank was put in charge of getting four Avro 504 airplanes, which were taken from Britain to Belfort in flatpacks, as it were, flatpack bombers, with Russian hieroglyphs on the outside of the flatpack cases to put anybody off. And when they were in the huge airship hangar on Belfort base, the British engineers who'd been brought down reconstructed them as four bombers, and eventually the weather was right, and four pilots came along, and three of them managed to take off, and they flew to Friedrichshafen. They weren't allowed to have a map because the French were frightened that if they were caught by the Germans and maps were found, they would see where they came from, and then the Germans would attack the French as a punishment. They had to memorize the trip. They'd never made it before. So they flew 120, 150 miles, something like that. They found the airfield. The first pilot, Babington, was shot down, or he landed anyway. He'd been shot with a bullet in the head, I think, and he landed and was taken off to be a prisoner. And the other two, they managed to drop their bombs. When they got back, it was a great propaganda success. It hadn't actually caused much damage at Friedrichshafen, but the propaganda success was immense and went whizzing all the way around the world and was in all the newspapers, showing that the British were up for a fight.
I think this is a really great example of strategic bombing for the RAF for perhaps the next 40 years, really.
Yes.
They don't achieve a great deal, but it's wonderful propaganda.
Yeah,
it's one of the earlier strategic bombing raids. They've had a couple of earlier ones against Düsseldorf and Cologne, again the same aim of attacking Zeppelin bases.
And the important thing is that, as far as Frank's story is concerned, is that when he got back to London, he was introduced to Winston Churchill, who was still at that stage the First Lord of the Admiralty, and Winston Churchill and Frank's immediate boss, who ran the RNAS, Murray Souter, decided to move Frank into the RNAS, where he was commissioned at the beginning of January 1915. And he was instructed to design and construct and commission and command the RNAS secret research establishment in Stratford, East London, which is pretty close to where the Olympic Stadium was built 8 years ago.
It's interesting, isn't it, that he joins the Royal Artillery initially.
Yes, and then he went to do this Friedrichshafen raid. He was commissioned into the RNV, the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve. And then when he got back, they then moved him into the Royal Naval Air Service and gave him this instruction to get cracking. Really, I think at that stage, the only thing in their mind was the Zeppelin. That was the thing that worried them. And he had impressed Souter that he got the measure of the problem and he'd got an answer for it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Just to go back to the raid, I do wonder, you know, when you read about his involvement, why he was brought along, it must have been his technical knowledge. rather than for the sort of bombing side of it. And you know, you wonder, is it because of perhaps an insight into how the factory might be laid out, where to attack? I don't know. There's something about his involvement which is really fascinating. You want more answers, don't you?
Yes, you do. And if you go to, the National Archives, in the National Archives, you spend months and months and months looking in the National Archives. You never, ever get all the answers. There's always more to find. So it may be there. But I would have thought that he must have put himself forward right at the beginning as somebody who understood or had a pretty good understanding of the Zeppelin. He'd already spied out the ground on his own initiative. And one of the things that Suter said about him was that the great thing about him was that if a problem came in, and problems came in every day, this is when he was an intelligence officer, he not only could assess the problem, but very often he came up with a solution. So he was that sort of fellow, very, very reliable and with a huge amount of intellectual horsepower and just perfect, really, I just think. Just extraordinary that those three, he and his father and his uncle, that little group of three were all extremely talented men. And sadly, it didn't go on.
I think just shows that he was just so immersed in the technology that they must have just understood it perfectly. It's really interesting to see how he takes that into the war. Now, before we go into the Brock bullet, because he didn't research that there, what's the research establishment sort of mainly focused on?
I think initially it's working for the RNAS to produce a solution to the Zeppelin problem. That is what happened when he would have been given his instructions, I suspect something like at the beginning of January 1915. He wouldn't have just been able to click his fingers and produce it. It would have had to been designed and built. And I'm sure he would have asked his father, Arthur Brock, who had produced the largest and most up-to-date firework factory in the world a few years earlier in Sutton, for some help in that task. It's only a guess, but I would think there were few people in the world who would have been able to help as well as him. And in the meantime, he went to King's North Air Base in Kent, and he was based there producing the bullet, and also he used the Sutton factory, the Brock's factory in Sutton, because I met one of the men when I worked at Brock's in the 1980s who had known some old-timers at Brock's, and they had reported that they'd seen Frank. He had a little hut on the outer reaches of the firework factory, and he was often seen leaning against his hut door shooting his 303 rifle at targets that he'd set up. So I think he was using the Brock facilities and the King's North Air Base.
The development stories which are in your book about the bullet, really fascinating, where he's sort of standing there firing them off from a rifle to sort of test them all. One of the sort of famous problems of the high explosive bullet, the Pomeroy and the Buckingham, and I never say Pomeroy right, so I don't know I'll have to check if I
yes, you did.
Said that correctly. It's a miracle then. I'll probably say it incorrectly from now on. But yes, the problem is there's quite a lot of early detonations, and that's one of the things they've got a safeguard against. When they come to design machines to attack the Zeppelins, they've got Lewis guns on top, partly because the open breech allows for a gun to cool a little bit better so they don't have premature bullets going off, but also because they can be directed upwards. But the Brock bullet, it gets sort of tarnished with that reputation of premature firing. But it's a little bit unfair, isn't it?
I think it is a little bit unfair. In there was a very long, detailed hearing after the war looking into the amount of money that had been awarded to the inventors. And it was clear that a miscarriage of justice had taken place, in that Frank's bullet had not been fully recognized. And in that hearing, it was clear that premature were not really a problem. When the officers were asked why they thought the Royal Flying Corps had used a different bullet to the RNAS, they said that they thought that it was down to the well-known at that time problem of inter-service rivalry. But the two other bullets, the Buckingham and the Pomeroy, the Buckingham essentially was like a tracer bullet. It burnt up at the back. And the problem was that you fired it off, and by the time it got to the Zeppelin, the tracer element had expired, so there was nothing burning. Or if the pilot was close enough to the Zeppelin for the tracer not to have expired, then the chances are that the heavy machine guns on the Zeppelin would have brought down the British plane. And the Pomeroy bullet only exploded when it hit something hard. It didn't explode when it hit the canvas of the Zeppelin. The point about Frank's bullet was that it was extremely sensitive and designed to blow up when it hit the fabric.
Yes, when you read through it, the impression that the men involved seem to have was that the Brock bullet was the sort of most critical. The Buckingham's very useful for, as much as anything, tracer fire. It is sort of an incendiary bullet, and then the Pomeroy, which is just a high explosive. And the crucial aspect of a Brock bullet is that it is both. It's a high explosive incendiary bullet. So it can puncture, cause a large hole compared to a normal 303, and also ignite the gas inside. Really critical.
Yes, the other two bullets did not explode each time they hit the Zeppelin. So the Pomeroy would only explode if it hit something solid. The Buckingham didn't really explode. But the Brock bullet did explode, as the Cambridge University Professor of Chemistry, Professor Pope, said. It was the equivalent of firing the bullet through a pocket handkerchief, and if it hit it, it exploded.
Yes, so all three types of bullets are used when the first Zeppelin is shot down by William Leif Robinson in September 1916. But it does seem to have been the Brock in particular which ensured that success.
Following the action, Leif Robinson's commanding officer told Frank that Leif Robinson had told his commanding officer that it was the Brock bullet which destroyed the Zeppelin. And what the pilots saw were lines of explosion along the Zeppelin. And that didn't happen with the other bullets. It happened with the Brock bullet. And that's why I think they were so convinced that it was the Brock bullet that made the difference.
Yeah, there's a wonderful story from Robinson describing the bullets exploding along the side, and then he sees the flame illuminating the back end of the Zeppelin, and he suddenly realises he's got to get away.
Yeah.
You can't help but stress enough that the Zeppelins really did loom large in the public's mind as a threat.
For, you know, from the spring of 1915 until the autumn of 1916, which was about 18 months, these massive things, much, much bigger than a jumbo jet, had been floating around, untouchable, dropping bombs, terrifying everybody. And we couldn't touch them. We just had no way of touching them. And then suddenly, and they would be watched by millions of Londoners who would come out and watch these things going around and being picked up by our searchlights. And then suddenly we get it down. And down it comes, a massive 600-foot-long cigar of burning hydrogen. And the relief felt, I mean, one feels for the poor Germans on the thing, but the relief felt by the British people watching it and the news that we finally found a way of stopping them must have been absolutely huge.
Interesting aspect about how this hit with searchlights and suddenly before is we better turn back rather than we better push on.
Yeah.
That's a real sea change. But speaking of sea changes, it's a sort of perfect segue, of course, into Brock's next part of his inventive work.
Yes.
Which is sort of supplement the minefield being put across from Dover and the Channel.
Yeah.
And by this point in the war, the U-boat really is taking a heavy toll on British shipping. There's a thought that our ability to continue, much as in the Second World War in the Battle of the Atlantic, that this is the pinch point. This is where if we're going to be stopped, it's going to be by the German U-boats.
Yeah. There are two different things. The smoke floats that he developed were used by not by the Royal Navy, but by merchant ships. He developed a very clever smoke float, which anybody could use because all they had to do was pick it up and throw it in the sea. And the float smoke did the rest and provided a huge volume of smoke to hide the merchant ship from the attacking submarine. So that was one of the things he did. Throughout 1917, he was working on all sorts of things, on bomb aiming, on color filters, on a whole host of different inventive activities. But by the end of 1917, Jellicoe, who was the chief of the defense staff, told the War Cabinet, when they asked him what our plans were for 1918, he said, well, if we can't do it, anything about the German U-boats sinking our shipping, there won't be any 1918. We won't be able to continue fighting. That was how important the submarines had become. The main German naval base was Heligoland Bight, which is up near the point where Germany meets Denmark, up in that area of the North Sea. Soon after the beginning of the war, they'd managed to get hold of Ostend and Zeebrugge and Bruges, and that is where they kept a lot of submarines. And Bruges is about 7 or 8 miles from the sea. It used to be a port in the medieval period, but it's silted up. So the Belgians had built a beautiful new canal running from Bruges to Zeebrugge. Zeebrugge means Bruges on the sea. And so they kept the submarines in Bruges in concrete-hardened pens for maintenance and so on, and took them up the canals both to Zeebrugge and to Ostend and out into the North Sea, where they were 200 or 300 miles closer to the channel, and therefore they could travel further. They were closer to their hunting grounds, which were the western approaches to the channel where all the merchant ships would congregate coming in. So we had tried many times to deal with Zeebrugge. We'd bombed it from the air. Monitors had fired at it from the sea. Passchendaele, the great battle of Passchendaele in the autumn of 1917, was fought partly or even mainly so that we could hook around and take over that part of the Flanders coast. And when Passchendaele descended into a bog and a failure, we were left with a very uncomfortable position. The War Cabinet decided, or I don't know who decided, to replace Admiral Bacon, who ran the Dover Patrol, with a man called Roger Keyes, who used to run the submarines. Roger Keyes took over from Bacon over Christmas 1917, and Frank Brock produced for him some huge new flares, which were called Dover flares or deck flares. They burnt at an illumination which could illuminate something like 3 square miles. And Keyes relayed Bacon's submarine nets and minefields. So nets had been strung across from England to France. They were held up at the top by buoys floating. The problem with them was that they sank, they bowed downwards between the buoys, and the German submarines would wait on the floor, and then at night they would just float up to the surface, go over the sinking bit of net, and on they went down into the channel. So Roger Keyes relayed those nets, and more importantly, or as importantly, he relayed the minefields, the deep minefields. And then he put these trawlers and drifters across the top of the nets from England to France. And on those trawlers and drifters, he put Frank's flares. The flares lit up the whole of that route so that any submarine trying to get over those nets, well, what they did actually do is to dive in panic through what they called the light curtain and straight into the minefields. And from the moment that those flares were used, German submarines began to be sunk. But it was not in sufficient numbers to take away the worry of where we were. And so Keyes then came up with another plan, which had been floating around for some time in one form or another, which was to attack Zeebrugge with a blocking maneuver. But any port that was worth blocking was very worthwhile defending. And therefore, any ship coming towards a heavily defended port would be sunk before it could get its block ship into the position it wanted to. And therefore, for this to work, Frank had to produce a new smokescreen. The Royal Navy had a smokescreen, but no smokescreen had ever been produced which did not give away its position by flame at night. And so that was what his task was, to produce such a smokescreen.
Yeah, I think this is a nice point just to recap. We've gone from the Dover flare, where he's been instrumental in providing illumination to force the submarines to dive down into the minefield. As you say, the minefield was never as successful as it's always hoped it would be. It takes a toll on U-boats far more when they are forced below the surface, but it's still not enough to negate that threat. And once again, Zeebrugge looms large in naval thinking in terms of can we take it out directly. In 1916, they've made attempts, innovative attempts to launch seaplanes close to Zeebrugge, launched on tenders so they could try and have shore bombardment of the lock gates. There's been attempts to bomb it by the air, as you say, numerous attempts to naval bombard. They've been thinking about capturing it directly. And now, once again, we're thinking to capture, to take Zeebrugge out, we need a new innovative measure. And this is where Brock's crucial, isn't it? Because, as you say, the smokescreen, which he develops, is incredibly dense and it's flameless. You mentioned in your book, it goes on to be used during the Second World War. There's a really nice video in the Imperial War Museum, actually, I've been meaning to share with you, where they show them sort of pumping it out. It's huge, billowing smoke clouds. But can we just run through, because Zeebrugge is a fascinating episode, but for those who don't know it, can we just run, what's the plan of attack?
So the plan of attack is that you can't just sail up to Zeebrugge and stick a couple of block ships. By the way, block ships are old naval, large naval vessels. I don't know if they were something like a cruiser, retired cruiser, where they would pump the base of the thing full of concrete and strip off all the metals that they knew the Germans were interested in, and then sail them up into the gates of the lock, which was at the head of the canal that led to Bruges. So they wanted to get around something called the Mole, which was the longest seawall in the world when it was built. When the Belgians created the port of Zeebrugge, that's what they built, 1.5 miles long. And so the block ships had to sail around the end of the Mole and sail across the inner harbour and drop themselves and blow their bottoms out right in the middle of the lock gate area. And so Keyes needed to put on a huge distraction so that the Germans would not be looking at things steaming round the end of the Mole and dropping themselves, but would be fighting for their lives. And so that's what Frank is involved with, putting on that distraction. First of all, to enable the raiding party to get close to the Mole, which he does with his smokescreen, and then producing masses of stuff for the actual attack, illuminating rockets, which would be fired continuously from the British ships to allow the block ships to see where they were going around the end of the Mole, different coloured signals to give signals to different people involved with it, a huge flamethrower, two flamethrowers, one on each end of the Vindictive, which was the main attacking ship, that each could fire a jet of flame 100 yards long, and a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah, and so we get into this episode where we attack Zeebrugge. But the development side of it, where he's working with Keyes, there's this immense pressure, isn't there, to develop this smokescreen.
Yes.
It really is what the whole operation hinges on.
Yes, and his particular chosen route is to use a chemical which was also used for a product called Saxin, which was a non-sugar sweetener for diabetics. And as he was producing this smokescreen, what he actually did was he moved down from Stratford with a few dozen of his men, and a little works was built for him in Dover Harbour next to Keyes's office. And in there, he made all these things, buoys, light buoys, smokescreen. He produced flame retardant to put on any wooden things. He was deeply involved in absolutely every aspect of this particular raid. And worryingly, at one time, there was a worry that there was not enough of the chemical that he needed. And so civilians were told that there was a health worry about this Saxin product. And because of that, they were going to reassess its safety, and they would not be supplying anybody with Saxin for a few weeks. And all that chemical was transferred to Frank to give him enough to build his sufficient quantities for the smokescreen.
This is such a fantastic story, isn't it? It both shows how important Zeebrugge is, but also the sort of duplicity in this. You know, they need the chemical, they can't reveal why. And so they create this sort of health scare attached to it, withdraw it from the market so they can produce enough of this smokescreen to go and attack Zeebrugge. It's fantastic. I think we're skipping on to what happens in Zeebrugge. The smokescreen's been developed. He's also developed other smoke-producing equipment for the ships to use further back. But it is the smokescreen itself. How's that created during the raid?
He creates at least two different smokescreens, one for the fast launches. And he comes up with the idea, which had not been thought of before, of giving launches, very fast launches, the ability to spread smoke. And whenever it had been thought of before, the idea would have been that the raiding party would have got sort of downwind of the thing, although in such a direction that the wind would have carried the smoke from the main task force onto Zeebrugge. But his idea was that these fast launches would whiz backwards and forwards in front of the harbour, spreading their smoke very, very fast. I don't know what they travelled at, 20 or 30 knots. And they would do that as well as the big ships spreading smoke. So one book about Zeebrugge said that Frank's smokescreen was like producing smoke very quickly enough to completely hide Tower Bridge. The idea was that the smoke would be laid, that the task force would go up, that the Vindictive would go beside the Mole, and the Vindictive had on its side a whole lot of ramps, wooden ramps, which would then be lowered onto the Mole because the Vindictive was lower than the top of the Mole. So these ramps would go up at a sort of 30 or 40 degree angle, and the landing party would then go up them and drop down onto the Mole and begin to attack the Germans. In addition, Frank created these two huge flamethrowers, one at the front, one at the back of the Vindictive. And these he was going to use against the German guns. In the event, the wind changed direction about half a mile before they got to the Mole, and all the smoke was blown away. The Germans knew something was coming, but they didn't know what it was. And when the smoke suddenly blew away, they were faced with quite a frightening sight, and they opened up with absolutely everything they had. The captain of the Vindictive, Carpenter, put the ship into full speed ahead, and they ended up next to the Mole, but a few hundred yards further down the Mole than they should have been, not really in a position where the flamethrowers could be used, although there was a story, a German story in the German archives of somebody seeing one of the flamethrower from the rear of the ship sending out a great big tongue of flame across the Mole. But I don't know if that happened. The problem was that the Vindictive came under absolutely massive fire, and the oil pipes leading to the two flamethrowers were severed by shrapnel or by bullets or shells.
So let's pull back, because the smokescreen's been developed. What's really important before we talk about what happens next is, again, to emphasize the thickness of that smoke. It very much is. It's described by some as being a pea super. But I don't know, for those of you who have been caught in a fog where you can't see your hand when you stretch it out in front of you, it's that thick. And the key is that the German guns, which are on the Mole, can't therefore attack the Vindictive. They know something's coming, as you're saying, but they don't know what, and they can't hit it accurately because Frank's smokescreens don't produce a flame, so they don't have any targeting points. And as this force is creeping towards the Mole in the smokescreen, there's suddenly the shift in wind. And they're exposed. They come under heavy fire. As I said, Vindictive comes up alongside the Mole. It's got these ramps, but it's further along than it had hoped to be. Heavily attacked. And those flamethrowers Frank's developed, which had been intended, I suppose, as a sort of surprise weapon as the huge ship emerges alongside the guns, they're suddenly negated because they've been under heavy fire for half a mile. But what's, I think, going to surprise most people is that Frank, who's now an RAF officer, because, of course, the creation of the RAF, the 1st of April, is on board the ship. He's aboard Vindictive. He's not just invented these smoke screens. He's an active participant in the raid. Now, how did that come to happen?
He's obviously got a highly scientific brain, and he's particularly interested. He was a great friend of Commodore Comtee, who ran the Harwich destroyer force. And he did a lot of work with him. And they were particularly interested in the German rangefinder, artillery rangefinder, which was better than ours. And he was absolutely determined to get one of these rangefinders. He was pretty certain there was a rangefinder on the mole, and he wanted to get onto it and have a look at it. And he persuaded Keyes, against Keyes's better judgment, to allow him to go on the raid. My own personal feeling, I've often wondered about it, but I think that when he would have seen all those dozens and dozens, dozens of people being cut up and killed in front of him, and thinking about all his old school pals who'd been killed, and he knew what people had been through.
You do sense that he was determined to be in this raid, you know, come what may, knowing full well how dangerous it was. So it's clearly this huge motivation to actually get involved. And I think you're right, seeing the contribution everyone else has made and feeling that you're not doing enough, it must be quite haunting, really. And certainly when they get to the Zeebrugge mole, Vindictive's further along, she's been pushed up against it by Daffodil.
So the backup forces are on another ship and can't get over onto the Vindictive. So it's a very difficult situation. And Frank, fairly well armed, he's armed with at least one revolver, his own curved cutlass. I think he probably had a knuckle duster. I certainly had a British intelligence issue knuckle duster, which my grandmother gave me as his, and he would have probably had that. He was a prize fighter, a boxer. So Frank went off towards where he knew the rangefinder was, and a grenade was thrown into there to make sure there were no German soldiers, their defenders, and then he went in and had a look at it. And the whole thing on the mole was so confusing. There was people, you know, a terrific amount of fire going on. There was smoke everywhere, German machine guns keeping everybody's heads down. It was difficult for people to tell exactly what happened. And afterwards, there were a lot of very heavily conflicting reports. But it seems that after he went in to inspect the rangefinder, and he may have picked up what he needed to know from that, he went down onto the main body of the mole, went towards the lighthouse end of it. And whether he went on to the lighthouse extension or not, it seems likely that he then attacked some gun positions, which were just before the lighthouse extension, and he attacked those with his revolver and with his fists. And the German reports come back saying that this British officer seemed to be completely without fear and was attacking them and sending them all running away. He fixed one of the guns, I think, spiked it. And then it seems that he moved on and put some explosive detonation charges onto one of the German boats, but a German sailor who from one of the torpedo boats moored near there came ashore, a man called Kun Kuni, and he began a fight with Frank, and they fought with swords or cutlasses, naval cutlasses. And the story that comes out of the German archives, seen by one of the German officers, is that Frank killed or lay a fatal blow onto Kuni, but as Kuni fell, he stabbed Frank through the neck, and they both fell dead a few feet apart. And they are both indeed still buried a few feet apart in the cemetery in the little church in Zeebrugge.
Yeah, it's quite well captured in your book, the sort of chaos along the mole. It's one of the sort of features of it. I don't think the Marines were involved with the 4th Battalion. I don't think the Marines ever raised another 4th Battalion. It's sort of a mark of respect about how intense the fighting was. Numerous Victoria Crosses are awarded. And as you detail in your book, it's a very confusing picture, so we can't be entirely certain. But I think your description of the sword fight certainly fits with what happened very accurately. So it seems likely that it was Frank there. And there's something almost Alexandre Dumas about Frank's life, isn't there? You know, this remarkable inventor who ultimately dies in a sword fight. You know, it really, you couldn't write a fiction book like it. But the Zeebrugge raid, it's slightly unfortunate that it isn't a success. It is a great sort of propaganda achievement for the British to sell. But the block ships, one of them's unfortunately sunk on its way in, so it can't block up the channel. And the other two attempt to block the channel by themselves, but they're subsequently moved when the Germans send a flood of water through.
That was the German view. And interestingly enough, the British establishment accepted the German view without any questioning. There's been a recent reappraisal of it called No Pyrrhic Victories. And he says that it's astonishing that the British establishment accepted the German view so quickly, and that there's lots of evidence to suggest that the German submarines and destroyers and so on were blocked up in Bruges and in the canal much, much more than the Germans intimated. That photographs taken over the following weeks and months showed exactly the same craft all sitting in exactly the same place. And he doesn't think that, technically speaking, the raid was the failure that it has sometimes been portrayed as. Also, there were a lot of internal politics at that time. So Bacon absolutely hated Keyes, and Jackie Fisher hated Keyes for reasons that aren't altogether clear to everybody. And so there were people within the British establishment who wanted Keyes to fail. The point made in the book, which is that Frank gave the British people two of the best feel-good moments of the war, is that in the spring of 1918, the Germans launched their spring offensive. We had spent years and years and years making a few yards here or 100 yards there or a mile there. In a period of a few days, they'd come through us something like 40 miles. And we were standing with our backs to the wall. And we thought, this, you know, we were facing the end. And then suddenly, Zeebrugge happened. And the propaganda spread around the world. And suddenly, Britain was not finished. We were still had plenty of fight in us. And it made a very big difference to everybody, to us, to our allies, to all sorts of people who suddenly saw the Germans were in trouble. And I think for many Germans, it was also a major event in the opposite direction, even though tactically it didn't make all that much difference. I think strategically or psychologically, it made quite a lot of difference.
The propaganda side of it is enormously valuable. It's interesting as well. I think it's worth perhaps ending on the effectiveness of the smokescreen, both as they get away from Zeebrugge, unfortunately not with Frank himself on board, but the ships are able to retreat away from the mole with a smokescreen laid, which covers their retreat very effectively. But also in a subsequent raid on Ostend, when they try and block the channel there, but again, the smokescreen seems to have worked perfectly. So the technology side of it was amazingly successful, wasn't it?
Yes. And the fact that not a single ship of ours was sunk on the way back, you know, despite the Germans having a terrific firepower on Zeebrugge, nothing was sunk because they kept firing over the top. They couldn't see us.
It just shows, I think, how effective that smokescreen was. And it is used in into the Second World War, the technology behind it, which he develops.
Yes.
As a number of the other inventions which he sort of propagates on. So it is, I think, a great point to end on, just to show how remarkably inventive he was, but also, you know, incredibly brave. The Zeebrugge Road shows he was.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I think before we go, Harry, it's a good opportunity for you to plug your book to our audience. It's Gunpowder and Glory. And do you want to tell us a little bit more just what exactly it covers?
Yes. The book Gunpowder and Glory is the first biography of Frank. But because he was such an extraordinary chap with such talent, we didn't want to just talk about Frank. So we had to explain the background from which he came, and also Brox itself, which was deeply involved, for example, with the British imperial project is as it were, a hidden history, which is worth noting. And so we were able to put the two things together, and it gives you a history of fireworks, of Brocs working in Britain and around the world. And then from this emerges Frank to run his really extraordinary life, where he really produced game-changing inventions and was one of the most effective British officers in the Great War. And this is his story.
Brilliant. Well, I think all that's left for me to do, Harry, is to thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.